It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It may have been a blue wave in the House, but there was clearly a riptide in the Senate. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Democrats picked up somewhere between 30 and 35 House seats, maybe making it the most confirmed and solid control of the House of Representatives in some time for the Democrats. That means that Nancy Pelosi is expected to become Speaker of the House once again and the onset of investigations into Trump's campaign. Meanwhile, Republicans made gains in the Senate, moving beyond the mere 51 that they had before November 6. That means President Trump's judicial nominees should be able to make their way to the bench, with warnings from Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to Democrats not to harass the president. Locally, the big upset was the defeat of Democratic State Senator Jim Mathias, a Republican. Mary Beth Carosa beat him. But GOP efforts in the blue state fell short of ending the veto-proof majority in the state Senate. And in Wicomico County, the independent challenge by Jack Hees to Republican County Executive Bob Culver fell far short of expectations as he came in third behind the unknown Democratic candidate John Hamilton. Take a look at the election results. We have in the studio Mike Prettle. He's with the Wicomico County Democratic Club. Also, Barry Tillman, a former mayor of Salisbury. Also, Michael Laughlin. He's Salisbury University political science professor. And also, Mark McGiver, who is the current chairman of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee. And welcome to you all. So let's actually start out first with something that is not election related, and that, of course, is the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. He was fired this week. He's been replaced by his chief of staff, I guess it is, Matthew Whitaker, considered to be a loyalist to Trump, at least from his previous remarks. I just want to go around the table here a bit. And, Mark, I'll start with you. What do you make of this firing and what seems to be a brewing now controversy over whether Whitaker is eligible to be the acting attorney general? What do you make of all this? Particularly, it came right after the election.
It's really no surprise that Trump was not happy with Sessions. I'm sure that Trump was advised to wait till after the election before firing him to avoid, you know, making a controversy. But he sure didn't wait long, did he? So that's typical Trump, and I think it's kind of entertaining. As far as his replacement goes, I don't know a lot about him, but this is certainly in our Constitution. This is what Trump can do. And I haven't heard controversy about the other guy too much. I'm sure that the media will play it up to be a controversial takeover of the Judicial Department, but that's not unusual in this day and age. So we'll see what happens from go forward.
Mike Prettle?
Well, having practiced law in Maryland for close to 50 years now, I guess, and followed much of what goes on in Washington, I think I can say without too much fear of contradiction, although my friend Mark may contradict me, that this is probably the least qualified person that's ever been appointed as the Attorney General of the United States. The man is on record as saying all sorts of good things about the right-wing extremist. He feels that we need people that believe in the Bible, and that should be the standard for enforcing the laws of this country. And his only qualifications, really, that appealed to Mr. Trump were the fact that he has written a number of op-eds where he said that the investigation of the president should be ended as soon as possible, and that it's a witch hunt, and he said all the right things that satisfied Mr. Trump that he was just the man for the job. So,
Michael Laughlin, how do you see this, particularly as a political science professor, in terms of the president making this appointment? There's some dispute about whether or not this coheres to the U.S. Constitution, which requires Senate confirmation, and there's also a law that designates who should actually do the succession, which some scholars believe would supersede the provision that the president certainly has used in order to make this appointment. What do you make in terms of that the political construct?
No question that there's going to be further debate, because essentially you jumped the Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein to put this fellow in as Attorney General. And so you have this strange composition where you're going to have an attorney general that was not confirmed by the Senate, yet Rosenstein was confirmed by the Senate, yet he's the junior player in the hierarchy. So I think there's going to be a further push, certainly from Senate Democrats, to try to push the Republican majority to reconsider this, probably to no avail, but I think that's what we're going to see. So I think the controversy is going to continue, and clearly what hangs in the balance is what would be done with the Mueller investigation. I mean, that's clearly what is front and center.
Mike, real quickly, do you think that we ultimately will see this sorted out in the courts and then go to the Supreme Court for them?
Very possibly, yes. And of course, but then the question is the timing. How quickly would that make its way up through the court system and before this fellow takes the action on the Mueller investigation? I mean, I think that's clearly what Trump wants him to do.
Barry, what's your reaction to
it all?
Well,
Mark made the point that the Constitution allows the president to do this. The Constitution allows the president to appoint, to submit a nomination for anyone he wishes to fill a particular department head position. However, the Constitution is also clear, as Michael Laughlin just said, in terms of the fact that whomever succeeds him in an acting capacity has to have had Senate confirmation. And, this guy hasn't. And Rob Rosenstein has had Senate confirmation. So it's clearly a case of, the president wants to manipulate the Justice Department. I mean, he's made that quite plain. I need a Roy Cohen. I need someone who's loyal to me. And he's got that. But the problem is that, I think he has circumvented the Constitution to get there. And that's not a good sign. It's not a good trend. Plus, I find it very interesting. In addition to the fact that, he could feasibly control the fate of the Mueller investigation, on a day-to-day basis, he controls the Justice Department, which controls, the enforcement of civil rights in the country, obviously immigration. I mean, this is a very powerful position, and it needs to be a position that is independent of, he's not the president's attorney. He is the attorney for the people, for the Justice Department. This is a guy who doesn't necessarily subscribe to one of the very first Supreme Court decisions made, Marbury versus Madison, that the whole judicial branch is pretty much based on these days. He says that the judicial branch is inferior to the inferior branch of government. So it's going to be interesting to see if this does reach the courts.
How it'll all play out.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be favorably disposed to some of his ideas. But I think the biggest thing is the fact that this is a very powerful position and is being held by a man whose only qualification is his loyalty to the President of the United States.
I want to give you the last word on this. Go ahead.
I appreciate that because it is three against one.
There you
I should
go.
Get the two last
words. Go ahead, though.
But to clarify, I was referring to Trump's firing of Jeff Sessions under the Constitution.
Yeah.
As far as the temporary appointment, I didn't mention that.
Okay.
So we'll wait to see that take the proper course.
Right. Well, I agree with you on the firing of the Attorney General. That is his prerogative.
Sure. That's great. We're off to a good start.
There we go. We agree on something.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, so I want to turn to what's considered to be at least a blue wave in the House of Representatives. The numbers are still, I guess, out. It could be anywhere from 30 to 35 House seats, which I think is actually greater than the 2006 takeover by the Democrats in that midterm election. I want to start with you, Mike Prettl. Is this a blue wave? How significant? Or is it a blue wave that'll dissipate as we head towards the 2020?
Well, as you already said, it's a blue wave in the sense that, as someone pointed out, that it is... It is not unusual for the midterm elections to go, the first midterm election in a new administration to go against the president. But as someone pointed out, that very often when that happens, it's because the economy is tanked and because there are all sorts of other things that have given reason to criticize the president. I think the last time you had a serious shift, there was a 9% unemployment rate. Now you have a 3% unemployment rate. It's certainly almost as much wave as we Democrats can expect to have happen. I think the important thing is that And it's both a positive and a negative, I guess, is that most of the shift, the waves, if you will, were in the suburbs. And they were, unfortunately, most of the few remaining moderate Republicans left in the House have now been lost to Democratic challengers. So what you've done is you've made the Republican Party more extreme. You've made it more the party of Trump, I guess. And I think it's interesting, too, that two other points. I sort of wrote down some takeaways from the election. Most of the challengers that won were women. You now have more women in the House than you've ever had. We're up to about 100, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's good for diversity, certainly. And virtually all of them were Democrats, all the women that won. And finally, it is interesting because, as you pointed out, there are still a number of cases of the things that are in play, mostly in the South. And I think that one of the things that I haven't heard commented on so far is the fact that it appears that the South is moving gradually away from the so-called Southern strategy. I mean, when you think about it, we have huge battles going on in Florida, in Georgia, and in Texas, where there was a serious challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, so the Southern strategy may have reached its bottom, after all these years of living through that. And, some of the Democrats will win, some will probably lose, but at least the challenges have been stronger than they have been in the past.
Mark, I want to go to you. What do you make? Is this a blue wave, or is this a blue wave that'll dissipate, do you think, in a couple of years? What do you think it means for the Republican Party?
I think they coined the phrase blue wave maybe 2 months out from this election. And ever since then, I think that the Democrats and media have been trying to back off of that. Blue wave 2 months ago implied a Democratic takeover of both the Senate and the House. And as we approached the election, it became obvious that the Democrats weren't going to take the House. And though then they tried to apply the term blue wave to just the House. Well, they took, 30 to 35 seats. I think when Obama's midterm was, he lost 60 seats. This is nothing. And it's not the tsunami that the media and the Democrats were predicting. And I do agree again with Mike. I apologize, Mike. I don't want to cause you any trouble. But the Republicans that did lose were the moderate Republicans. And then on the other aspect, in the Democratic side, we see that more radical Democrats have been elected in some of these gerrymandered districts that, were aimed to get Democrats elected, but they ended up being even more radical Democrats, socialist Democrats, and they're younger and they're getting into the House. What's going to be interesting is Nancy Pelosi's control of the House. I think that this new Democratic House majority could be a problem for Pelosi because Pelosi may not be liberal enough for them. They may want to pull the Democratic House more to the left. Just as Mike had pointed out, the Republican Party seems to be more to the right. It looks like we have a House that is more divided than it's ever been.
How do you see, by the way, Mark, how do you see the Republicans now in the minority, at least for the moment? What do you think their approach is going to be in terms of this Democratic majority in the House? I mean, we have Paul Ryan, he's out. Any guesses to who's going to take over as leader in the House?
I really don't know. Obviously, the Republicans are familiar with running the House as a minority, and I don't know. It's going to be a very interesting two years
Do you think they're going to just simply vote no? I mean, given whatever the Democratic majority wants, I mean, in terms of legislation, that it will be so far out of what they want? I mean, are we just going to a solid no, you think?
Probably. Yeah, I think the Democrats would be very resistant to go along with the liberal and the Nancy Pelosi agenda. I think they'll be fighting it.
Go ahead, yeah.
I mean, some people have felt that the Freedom Caucus now is in control of the Republican part of the House, and you know that the moderates there have all been dissipated, and that it will be more extreme. I disagree with my friend Mark that that most of the Democrats that were elected are not radicals. There were one or two that were somewhat extreme that mostly got defeated. The people that were elected were mostly suburban women who have come around to a moderate position, mostly pushing health care, which is certainly not it's certainly the majority of Republicans now are favoring health care and as a major interest of the federal government. And most of them are elected on that basis.
Barry, yeah, in fact, I'm going to turn to you, Barry. We had over 100. And as far as we know, and as a matter of fact, and we will get one out of Arizona no matter what happens, although right. It does look as if the Democrat has edged slightly ahead, right. And the analysis that I saw, by the way, is that the votes that are outstanding actually may come from areas that actually favor the Democratic candidate. But what do you make of this wave? I mean, is it unexpected? Is it just because of Donald Trump?
No,
I mean,
no,
what is
yeah,
it?
I think
what
the,
do you think?
The women who were elected, I mean, they have a secret weapon, and they're going that weapon is, I think, going to be the gift that continues to give over the next 2 years, and that's Donald Trump. I mean, he is clearly a misogynist at best, and he is constantly alienating women and minorities, and I think that that has led to a broadening of the Democratic base, and I think that's one of the reasons that women not only were elected, but that women ran. You know, and it's you know, it's the Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. Well, when they go low, we go vote. And I think that's pretty much what we saw happening. And I'm reminded of something my dad said. He'll be dead 15 years this year. He told me one time about 10 years before he died, he had just stopped supporting men. And I said, Daddy, why are you sending money to, it was at right after the Year of the Woman in 92. And he said he was supporting Emily's List and lots of different women's, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer. I said, Daddy, you're a pretty conservative guy. Why are you doing this? He said, because I figure men have had their shot and it's time to give women a shot.
Let me ask you this, because you've run as a woman in a male-dominated mm-hmm. Electorate in terms of the results. What do you make of the experiences that these women have had and the fact that they seem to, not easily, I don't think, but nonetheless, have they had to change the way they run, do you think? I mean, what is that like?
No,
you
know, I think I think the ones that I have seen and read, you know, interviews with, basically they're talking about what people are talking about and what people care about. Mike indicated, you know, healthcare. The reality is they're talking about the dinner table issues, the kitchen counter issues, you know, the fact of healthcare. I saw a woman interviewed who is not running, but who was actively campaigning, and she talked about having a 7-year-old daughter who was diagnosed with cancer, and she's terrified of losing pre-existing conditions because that would make health care impossible for her daughter. And I think that these women have an intimate knowledge of what goes on in households on a daily basis. And I think that they're veterans. One's a helicopter pilot. You know, we had our Tammy Baldwin who had her baby this year, and you know, is a veteran. And so I think that it's not just a case of women kind of modifying their views. I think they're just finally coming forward with their views and saying, you know, it's time for a change. Try Women for a Change was a bumper sticker I can remember from the early 90s.
So man, we should, by the way, note that in Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn, a Republican, won that seat against a man as well. So they are Republican women are out mm-hmm. there. But in the Senate, we saw a riptide, as it were, in which the blue wave did not necessarily make the difference. Matter of fact, we understand that the Senate probably will increase in terms of Republican representation. Bill Nelson, he's still up for grabs, but he could very well go down. Claire McCaskill out of Missouri went. Heidi Heitkamp out of North Dakota. Joe Donnelly out of Indiana. We saw a number of candidates go down to defeat in terms of the Democrats. I'm going to turn to you, Mark. What do you make of the Republican gains in the Senate? And with the one observation, that is that I understand in 2 years, the situation that faced the Democrats, i.e. that they had more seats up than Republicans, that's now going to be reversed in 2 years. Does that concern you as well? What do you make of being able to hang in there?
Yeah, it's interesting. This election term in the Senate, there were 23 Democratic seats that were open for up for election, and then only 9 Republicans. We definitely came into the midterms with an edge, so to speak. But that being said, people keep criticizing Donald Trump because they're blaming him for, well, everything. But the end result, at the end of the day, he came through and he saved the Senate in the midterm. And that's virtually unheard of. So I think it's saying that that Donald Trump is a strong leader. He is popular. And he does have a very good chance to take over the presidency again in 2020. And as far as the Senate numbers going against the Republicans in 2020, we'll have to see. But if Donald Trump continues to run strong, if his support is good, the Democrats will have coattails to contend with. In order to take over the Senate in 2020.
What do you make of the, let's assume, for instance, the Republicans take Florida. Obviously, they've taken Texas, for example. But those were close. I mean, they should have been walkaways, particularly Texas should have been a walkaway. Is that any concern in terms of what's happening in the South and the fact that it was so close? Or do you think those were just attributed to the particular candidates and their particular charisma, as it were? What do you make of that closeness? I mean, Texas should have been a walkaway, right?
I would have thought Texas would have been a walkaway. I was surprised to see that Cruz was in a toss-up situation, but he did pull through. I don't know enough about the details, whether it was the personalities involved, but to say that Florida is traditionally Republican, you can't say that with a straight face and remember about the presidential controversy, with, was it Gore and Bush back then? I mean, it doesn't get any closer than that. I mean, Florida was cut straight down the middle, Democrat-Republican way back then. But I will say I'm disappointed in Florida. We are a country of laws and rules, and apparently— they're alleged that 2 counties in Florida did not follow the rules of the election, that we don't have all the results in from these counties, that it has opened up a controversy or a possible to say that maybe they even cheated in the election or in the process of trying to steal it. And that's a shame. I mean, this is the United States of America. Our elections should be free, open, and free from controversy. And that's not what's going on now in Florida. And it's just a shame that these 2 counties, Broward and Palm Beach County, can't abide by the rules. They still haven't reported, apparently, how many voters have voted in that county and even turned in the ballots yet. So it's a shame that this kind of behavior continually seems to happen time and time again, and more often. The rules don't seem to matter in this country anymore.
I want to go to Mike Prettle. By the way, Mike Prettle, that the 2 particular counties will decide whether there's anything funny going on. They have been messy from the start.
No question. The
old person that was in charge got thrown out. There's talk about the new person being thrown out. I mean, but go ahead.
I'm afraid that my friend Mark has been watching Fox News again.
No.
I mean, candidly, the two states that are in controversy now, namely Florida and Georgia, in both of those states, the Democrat is saying, let's count all the votes. The Republican is saying, no, I won. Cut it off. Scott has already declared that he's the winner, and he's ready to. He's got his transition team in place, and we're saying, hey, there's votes to be counted. So, to the extent that there is shenanigans going on, the Democrats are the ones who want to take it slow and let's count every vote that and make sure that the result is in accordance with the law. And the Republicans are the ones saying, no, we don't need the count anymore. I mean, the Georgia situation, I think, was incredible that here the Secretary of State is in charge of the election process, and he's also running for governor. And he is disqualifying people left and right. And, you know, it talk about complying with the law. I mean, I don't think the Georgia situation will withstand challenge in the courts when it all plays out.
We'll see about that. Yeah. Michael Laughlin, particularly... what strikes me is that as you know, as for instance, you look at the House, it tends to be more representative in terms of just overall voters, right? Although we do have gerrymandering, the states, on the other hand, were undemocratic institutions from the start for some obvious reasons. What do you make of the fact that the Republicans did make gains in the Senate, did lose some in the House? Maybe they'll come back in 2 years. From a political standpoint, political science standpoint, what do you make of that?
Let me address it this way. I'd like to unpack further the whole concept of a blue wave.
Yeah.
The House of Representatives is your best indicator of what the electorate feels at a particular moment, because all 435 districts are up for election. The Senate is less so because you only have a third each time. So I think the fact that you have not only an uptick in the minority party's gains, because that's always occurs at midterms, but doesn't always occur that the minority party takes control of the House. In this case, it did. The other piece of this, I think, is important as to whether or not what is going to be happening in the future. Is this simply a flip that can flip back? And when you look at some of the exit polling, and you look at the gender, education, and the youth vote, we find some interesting dynamics here. The Democrats won women by 60 to 39% this time around. In the 2014 midterm, right, it was split evenly. So you have a tremendous jump from the 2014 to the 2018 in terms of the gender gap. For men, interestingly, in the 2018, it was Republicans won at 50% to 48%. In 2014, Republicans won it by 16%, right? Now, it is unlikely that the Democrats have made major gains in terms of any long-term standing with men. But for women, this is what's really good. If I were a Republican, I'd be really worried about what is happening to the suburban white woman, the upper educated, because those have been a reliable Republican vote. Because the gender gap has been there, but primarily because of African-American women. It's black women who have been the real committed Democratic vote. White women, they voted for Trump, right? Is that going to hang? Is that going to stay with you? If you say Trump's going to do well in 2020, you're going to have to win these women back. And the real question here is whether or not there's been a realignment. And the whole concept of realignment is a sustained change in partisan dynamic here. And now, whether this is indicative of that, we will have to see. But this is clearly troubling, I would think, for any Republican strategist going forward.
Mark, I'm going to go to you for a moment, because are you concerned that this kind of shifts that he's talking about will be permanent? Or do you think that, particularly when we're talking about the women's vote, that may very well just simply be specific to Donald Trump and all the controversy that surrounds him? I mean, are you concerned that the trend that he sees that he's looking at?
I'm glad you asked, because unfortunately, in America, it seems like we're a little fickle and we don't have long memories. You know, a year ago, we were very concerned. Our biggest concern was national security. We were all appalled when Trump referred to the North Korean dictator as Rocket Man. And a year later, no one's concerned. It's not even a concern about national security. Trump's handled it. The economy was a big concern a year ago. But guess what? The economy's doing great. It's never done better. Our unemployment's never been lower. And so I think what's happened, and I think what we're talking about now is the media and the Democrats have been able to change the scope of the discussion of the election. And they said now the biggest concern that the white women have, suburban women, is health care. Well, guess what? Health care is a concern because Obamacare was a disaster. If that's who knows what the main topic will be 4 years from now. I mean, we are so fickle as a society. You know, 1 month, this is the main thing. This is what we're going to vote at. And then the whole emphasis shifts just 30, 60, 90 days to take a polling now and try to predict what's going to happen 2 years from now is not really realistic.
Barry, I'm going to turn to you because I'm curious about whether or not the shift that we're talking about, particularly in terms of women, whether or not that is just simply a Trump phenomenon in which they're, you know, turned off by some of the things he said, or whether that's going to be more permanent once he leaves the stage.
Well, I think that it's not just Trump. He's the chief elf in charge of the wind-up toys over at the in the Senate, has been in the Senate, and unfortunately the Senate majority has not stepped up to fulfill its constitutional role of being a check and balance on the presidency. They've been a rubber stamp, and I think that a lot of this this blue wave, this phenomenon, this flip from of suburban white educated women going to the Democratic Party is because people are tired of the whole system not working. They're tired of the president. They're tired of the tweeting. They're tired of the mean-spirited, incredible things that he says and does. But they're also very tired of a completely feckless and ineffective Republican Senate. And I think that over the next 2 years, certainly the Senate will have the opportunity, albeit a Republican majority, they will have the opportunity to work in a bipartisan manner with the Democratic House to get things done. I've listened to some new congresswomen-elect being interviewed over the past few days, and they're not going there to block Trump or to be difficult for Donald Trump or to check Donald Trump. They're going there to get things done. They've heard clearly, women and men that will be entering the Congress in January, they have heard clearly that people want something better than what they've got. They want it to work, and they want things to happen. They want health care to be fixed. It's amazing. You know, if Obamacare was such a ridiculous disaster, why didn't the Republicans who have been in control of the Congress and now the presidency for 2 years, why didn't they fix it? I mean, they tried to do was repeal what was there. They didn't come up with great ideas, and people are disgusted with the fact that there is this partisan bickering. So this is a sustainable wave, if indeed something comes of it.
So I'd add just real quickly, a couple other more indicators of a blue wave that's moving. If you look at the ballot initiatives, what's fascinating, ballot initiatives in Arkansas, Missouri, minimum wage increase. In Florida, the initiative to give former felons their voting rights back passed in Florida. Medicaid expansion in Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah. These are not blue states. They now are expanding Medicaid. If Obamacare was so terrible, why are these guys now coming around, right, to the majority of states expanding Medicaid, which is an important part, which is health care? So I think that these issues, so what's interesting I find is that we have issues that lean more Democratic than Republican. These are all issues that not only blue states support, but now we have red states supporting it, particularly Arkansas, Missouri, minimum wage increase I found. Mark, fascinating.
Because I want to turn to you, because it seems as if sometimes that the ground is constantly shifting underneath conservatives. I think particularly of gay rights, both gays in the military and, of course, marriage equality, in which we saw tremendous shifts in terms of public opinion. That used to be a stalwart. Matter of fact, there were things on the ballot in 2004 to oppose, for instance, gay marriage as an example. And as he points out, there are other things such as the increase in minimum wage and Medicaid expansion and so on. Is some of the ground shifting? How do you see that in terms of what the Republican Party has traditionally stood for and whether or not there's some change in it.
I mean, well, we can take minimum wage. You talk about minimum wage initiatives in some of these ballots.
Yeah.
These obviously started years ago in order to get it on the ballot today. But and that's typical of government. With its, it reacts slowly. If it's trying to regulate technology, if it's trying to regulate social change, it always seems to be, the change always seems to happen before the law gets in place, or the law is almost obsolete before it gets there. And let me point out to you that these initiatives for minimum wage took years to get on the ballot, and they passed. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we elected a president. He stimulated the economy with tax cuts. And now the unemployment rate is at, what, 3.7, did you say, Mike? And what that means is not just in these two states the minimum wage went up. That means across the country the minimum wage went up because of the laws of supply and demand. There's less people out there to get a job. So,
would you agree?
Let me finish. Yeah, sure. The less people out there applying for jobs means that employers have to pay more for employees, particularly good, dependable, drug-free employees, are going to do very well in this economy. So that kind of supersedes what's going on in these two states.
But these two states, people voted in the majority for the increase in the minimum wage. That means they're supportive of that kind of law, that kind of government.
Republicans opposed it, mostly.
Yeah, so I don't think that does. I mean, I think that the Trump election occurred in 2016. This is 2018. And you have people in these red states who are coming out in favor of, we want the law to change, which indicates that they want the government. So they're not just embracing the free market. I'm not even disputing part of your logic in terms of free market economics, but clearly this is indicating that people favor law that says we should increase the minimum wage.
I'm going to give Mark the last word here on this.
I think we'll just have to disagree. I mean, that could be your interpretation of cherry picking across the country certain laws and drawing conclusions on a nationwide basis. But I just don't agree that that's necessarily valid.
Let me go. Okay. So then we had the president's reaction to the election results. And one of the things that obviously people have been talking about, in 2006, when George W. Bush got hit with losses, he called it a thumping. President Barack Obama in 2010 with the Tea Party movement, he called it a shellacking. 2018, Trump called it a very big win. I'm assuming that he's talking certainly about the Senate. And he did seem to berate those particular politicians who lost, who seemed to distance themselves from him. So I'm just going to go with Mark here. So what do you make of the reaction of the president? I mean, what do you think? Much different than the previous, I don't know. But you tell me, and particularly the sharp criticism that he had of listed the names, right, of the people who supposedly didn't identify with him, and I don't know. I mean, it was very strange to me. But they did not identify with Trump himself. That they they wanted to keep some distance, and he listed a bunch of names of the people who did that and who lost,
right.
And as if, well, see, if you weren't for me, then you lost. And I mean, I'm not sure what to think about that, but what did you make overall about his reaction? I mean, he decided to declare victory.
And I
do you agree with him? It was a victory?
I guess, do.
Yeah.
I do agree with that.
Yeah.
I like Trump. I identify with him. Matter of fact, his approval ratings are the highest that they've ever been for Trump. They are actually higher than when Obama was in office at this time during his presidency. So Trump's doing very well. I think he's a popular president. Now, as far as midterms go, they're always problematic for presidents that have, you know, been in office for 2 years. And I think they sat down and they developed a strategy. And as his advisors, and I think Trump probably knows this instinctively, that if he lost both houses, the Senate and the House, then he would be in deep trouble. And so they said, well, how are we going to shore us up? Let's make sure that we keep the Senate intact. And I think that's probably what his objective was from the beginning. And he certainly campaigned to do that. There's no president in history did the 11 the 11 events that he did across the country, the rallies that were unbelievable sellouts, crowds just, you know, thousands of people were stuck outside of the rally because they were too crowded. They couldn't get in. So he did these rallies. He rallied up his base, and he was successful. He and the Senate, we actually made gains in the Senate in a midterm, which
what
is great.
What do you make of Governor Larry Hogan, who said that the election results were repudiation of the president? He's a Republican. Has distanced himself from Donald Trump. He calls it a repudiation to bring it sort of home to the state. I mean,
I like Larry Hogan. he's a great governor. And I've been asked this before how to compare the two. And I said that Donald Trump, really people don't like Donald Trump, but they like what he does. With Larry Hogan, they like Larry Hogan, and they also like what he does. So, I think the end result between the two, Governor Hogan and President Trump, are a net positive. People like what they do.
Want to turn locally. The biggest surprise
briefly. I mean, frankly, I don't know how many of you saw this press conference. That was the most bizarre press conference ever given by a president. I mean, he started off by talking about this great victory. He ended up by saying, if you guys try to exercise any oversight, we're at war. He said, this is a war. He blasted the reporters. He blasted the African-American woman for being racist. He told the CNN guy that he was a bad man and he was never going to get in the White House again. It was an incredibly strange press conference that we've never seen the likes of before.
Well, this is a different era, I suppose.
Well, I think I will talk with people and they say, well, that's Trump. Well, that's okay if you have a reality show on ABC or whatever, but it's not okay if you're the president of the United States. People listen to the president. They take cues from the president. They depend on the president. And I mean, I couldn't watch the whole thing. On Wednesday, but I mean, it was a very unhinged performance.
I want to turn to the local politics. Mary Beth Carrozza, that was the biggest surprise to me. Delegate defeated State Senator Jim Mathias. And we should note, by the way, that Jim's elections have always been pretty thin. I want to start with you, Mark. Actually, so what do you think Mary Beth won? I mean, I want to give you lots of time here because we got to these other guys here. What happened here? Was it just a tipping point here?
Mary Beth is an incredible person. She's going to be a very good and very popular senator for us. We're very lucky to have her serving our Eastern Shore in the Senate. Her victory really wasn't a surprise, but it wasn't an easy victory either. Mary Beth is one of the hardest working candidates I've ever been associated with. I think that she probably personally knocked on 10,000 doors over the last 2 years. And I'm not kidding. I mean, this girl, she's just full out. She organized a great grassroots effort. She motivates the the organization from in front. She was out door knocking day in, day out, had organizers doing it. She just ran a very good grassroots organization. And when you had mentioned his Jim Mathias's earlier races, when I was doing some research for this election cycle locally for our candidates here in Wicomico County, I looked at the old polling, the old election results from 4 years ago, and Jim had only won by 30 votes in the last cycle. So he never was an overwhelmingly popular senator. And even the previous cycle, he didn't win by that much. Even when he was a delegate, he didn't win by that much. So I like Jim personally. He's a great guy, but I think we got a good one in there with Mary Beth. She's going to be a great representative for us.
Mike Prettle, what happened here? Was it just inevitable? I mean, I noticed, for instance, when I was looking at the returns, that Carrozza actually got something like 12,000 to 10,000 in Worcester County, which I would say sort of surprised me, since that sort of Ocean City territory where he was mayor, a lot closer in terms of why come up on Somerset County. What happened? Was it just inevitable?
He was the last surviving Democrat. I mean, he was the last victim of the Republican wave, if you will, on the Eastern Shore, which it took over the last 10 years or so. But and he has run very, very close races in the past. I like Jim. I think he's a great guy. I've never met Mary Beth Groves, and I don't live in that district. I live in the other district. I do have to say, from the standpoint of the campaign, she may have run a great knocking on doors campaign. I was incredibly turned off, as were a lot of people, by the advertising that was done on her behalf in that campaign. She started off in the spring talking, accusing Jim of supporting heroin addiction. She ran ads saying that he wanted to give heroin to users. Okay, I saw the ads, and I actually wrote a letter.
Were they hers, or were they somebody else's?
No, there was a
bill. I think there was somebody else, right? Yeah.
No, there was a bill in the legislature to set up so-called houses where people could get off of drugs. And it was supported by the Baltimore City Health Department. And Jim was asked to put it in because he was on the committee. And he put it in. He wound up voting against it, and they withdrew it. But Mary Beth tried to utilize that. In the end, though, I mean, I thought the ads they ran during the last 2 weeks before the election, where Mary Beth was made a big deal about the fact that she could work with Governor Hogan, okay? They ran these ads saying that Jim Mathias worked with the bad guys. They used the word bad guys, referring to Mike Miller and Mike Bush, and made them look like they were the mafia, you know? And I thought that was, and now she would say that they weren't my ads, they were the Republican governor's ads, but certainly they were done on her behalf, and I think they were very effective. She appeared in them, and she basically, I thought it was beneath her and beneath any candidate running to accuse the members of the heads of the legislature who Mr. Hogan has been trying to work closely with, and she's going to the Senate to work under the bad guy Mike Miller, who she has basically castigated. I thought it was ugly, and it was stupid for her to do that.
It seems to me, just a barrier here. That's politics. I mean, if that's what you've got, maybe a lot of people support Larry Hogan here on the shore.
But she has to go to Annapolis now and work in the Senate under the leadership of the man who she said is a bad guy. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
Dr.
O'Loughlin and I were talking briefly before. The thing is that the governor stood up there and said, I need Mary Beth Carrozza in order to get my bipartisan agenda. And then he goes time and time again, your senator, Jim Mathias, has voted with the bad guys. Not the Democrats, not the other side, the bad guys. And that is a symptomatic of what's wrong politically. And the ad that was sent out in the spring showed an ice cream truck handing out heroin. Now, that's just, I mean, I was the victim I was the target in my first reelection campaign of some things that were just, you know, kind of beneath the dignity of my opponent and that kind of thing. And you know, there's a pointing out logistic or logical and rational differences, not only in terms of what people believe, but in terms of what people have done is fine. But that just, there are certain things that just slip beyond the pale or down to the, as a race to the bottom. And I agree with Mike that she's got to go now and work with one of these bad guys.
But if you want to slip down to the Wicomico County Executive, Bob Culver wiped everybody out, about 15,000 votes, something like that. John Hamilton, the Democratic nominee, nobody had heard of, 9,300. Jack Heath, the independent, who I know that Mike Prettle, you were involved with, only 6,600. What went wrong? Was this just simply a bad idea in terms of at least the way it was done?
Well, he had run as an independent for the Salisbury City Council and won successfully. And I have tremendous respect for Jack Heath, you know, and he believes that we shouldn't have party division and that something should be above party. So he decided to run as an independent. Those of us on the Democratic side were very concerned that we have loyal Democrats in this county who are going to vote Democratic in almost every race, which is great, except that in this race, we felt that they should vote for Mr. Heath rather than Mr. Hamilton, who was nobody knew him, and he had no track record. I think he had run previously as a Republican. So we tried to get the word out to Democrats that that Jack Heath was the person that Democrats should support. And unfortunately, we weren't successful. It's almost impossible to reach people who are used to voting Democrat. So we're glad there are so many loyal Democrats in the county, but in this case, it backfired, and we were not able to do that.
Well, you know,
political
science 101 is that the most dependable predictor of a person's vote is their partisan identification. And this is a classic case, right? There was insufficient communication. I mean, even though the Democrats tried to say, no, do split your ticket. Most people, Democrats,
I want to turn back to Marcus. The other thing that happened, as I recall, because I was reading it, is that on the county council itself, two Democrats actually got elected. So now you've got a total of, I guess, a three on the county council. It used to be,
six to one,
yeah. Right? So what happened there in terms of those? I mean, in that particular case, the D seemed to work out. I mean, was it just particular candidates that were fielded in the Republican side? I mean, you obviously are far more deeply involved than maybe any of us involved with that. What do you make of that? I mean,
well, there was, first of all, talking about Jack Heath, he would have had a better chance being a write-in candidate than to run as an independent.
Or how about as a Republican?
Well, he could have very well changed his party affiliation to Republican and took Bob Culver on in a primary. That could have been one viable option for Jack Heath, but he chose not to do it. He could have switched over to a Democrat and run as a Democrat, and he didn't do that. And I don't think he got the best advice in the world getting to be running as an independent. As far as losing the other two seats, we just didn't turn out the votes on that. One at-large seat, there were some issues involved that were beyond anyone's control. The other one was John Hall's old seat. I really like John Hall. He's been a great councilman for years.
Everybody loves John Hall.
Yeah. But he represented a very, blue area in our county. And, Bob Culver, Caldwell. Bob Caldwell. Had achieved that, got that seat, but only by 8 votes. It's been a very tough seat for Republicans to keep, and we were just overwhelmed in this Tuesday in the District 4 seat. Mm. Yeah.
The other thing, the other candidate, obviously the big election was Congressman Andy Harris. Cruised right through with 60%. Jesse Colvin was a bit of a surprise candidate. He picked up only 37%. Colvin raised a lot of money. I saw a couple of ads. I'm not sure they were all that effective, but I saw them. So what are we to make of the fact that this was an easy win? Mike Prettle, what about you?
Well, we supported.
Because I know you worked on his campaign.
Yeah. Well, I've worked on all of the first district campaigns for the last 5 or 6 times around, and we supported Frank Carradarella, and we supported the previous Democrats. It was a district that was, frankly, I hate to use the word gerrymandered because it has a bad word, but frankly, if I were doing the redistricting, I would probably put all of Delmarva in the one district and maybe even take it where it is now. So I don't think it's a gerrymandered district, but it is a district that was deliberately set up to house most of the emerging Republican majority, if you will, in the rural areas of the state, and as reflected in the fact that we're now 7-1 in our congressional representation. But so it's a very tough it was a very tough road to hoe. When Jesse Colvin came along, he took us all sort of by storm. I think he was a fantastic candidate as a person. You know, he had this military background, which was great. He was very, very articulate. I think he was very good on the issues. Certainly not a liberal. He didn't run as a liberal Democrat. He ran as a good moderate. You know, and he was a newcomer, and I thought he did a great job of getting out and getting around. He hit 12 counties in the last 12 days before the election, including an event that we had for him. But Andy Harris has been around long. People tell me that Harford County loves Andy Harris, and I'm not sure what he's done for them, but people on the shore don't feel he's done much for us, and
I'm sure Republicans might chase for differ, but I'm sure some Republicans might differ with
well,
that.
Well, I mean, you know, he has been a reluctant vote in our favor on the Chesapeake Bay. He did not support Crisfield when it was underwater and after Sandy, you know, and the people down in Crisfield are still unhappy about that, mm-hmm. you know. So, I mean, I could pick on Mr. Harris for all sorts of things. I've written a number of op-eds criticizing for various and sundry. But he's a strong candidate, and I'm not sure that we're ever going to... We felt if any Democrat could win, it probably would be a Colvin-type Democrat. And I'm not sure that anybody's going to take that seat.
That brings me to redistricting. We have this decision. It looks like as if Maryland will have to start redrawing. I'll start with you. My concern is you've read the opinion.
Well, I read the opinion. I'm on the opinion. I'm counsel of record.
Okay, counsel of record.
No, I'm in an awkward position because I'm on the board of Common Cause Maryland, which was the amicus there and which is leading the charge against gerrymandering in many, many states. It's an unusual situation because there's no question that the 6th District, which is the only one that was involved in the litigation, the 6th District was deliberately changed to accelerate, I guess, the Democratic support there, and it worked. And instead of we used to when we were younger, it was 4-4. Now it's 7-1 Democratic. But the problem is this, that it's sort of an issue that cries out for a nationwide solution. And the Maryland legislature, somewhat to their blame and somewhat to their credit, have dodged the issue by saying, we will set up an independent commission to do this if other states will do so also. But why should we do the right thing, that is to take it away from the politicians, if the other states, the states that are controlled by Republicans, won't do it? And you could talk about situations in Pennsylvania, you could talk about Virginia, you could talk about North Carolina, which is probably the most egregious that the courts have thrown out half dozen times, and they still are fighting to gerrymander in favor of the Republicans. You could talk about Texas. So, I mean, Maryland is willing to do it if other states will do it. I've read the decision, which I thought was very well articulated by Judge Niemeyer. He said that both from the standpoint of representation and from the standpoint of association, both of which are the virtues under the First Amendment, or power or rights under the First Amendment, this should not happen. It's my thought, frankly, that perhaps the state should appeal the decision, not because it's wrong, but because it might lead to a national recognition that would apply to all the states, including the ones that are more heavily gerrymandered than we are, and the ones that are. But, I mean, there's much more gerrymandering. Mark raised the issue of gerrymandering. Most of the serious gerrymandering that's going on is done in states that are controlled by the Republicans.
It used to be the Democrats.
Maryland's the only state.
As a matter of fact, because I came from the state of California, and they were the finest gerrymanders in the world.
But now they have a commission. But right. the few states that have picked up commissions are ones that the Democrats have asked for. So.
Let me introduce real quickly, Michael Laughlin. If there was redistricting across the nation, how do you think, within last minute, that would change what we're seeing then, particularly in terms of the House?
I think it would underscore the demographic shift that would favor Democrats. So I think that if you had some agreement on independent commissions across the states, Republicans would suffer, I think, because I think that what we're seeing, the demographic shift that we saw in these exit polls, I think is indicative of a movement in favor of the Democratic Party at this point in time. Because Republicans could shift, they could change what they're doing, and they could begin to grab back some of what the Democrats are getting almost by default. You know, with the Hispanic votes, Hispanic voters, African Americans, and certainly now this white suburban.
But even this time, Democrats got 10 million more votes than Republicans did in this election.
Yeah,
that's not valid, Mike. And let me
it's
make
not
a
valid. Point. It's in numbers.
I would like to respond to Mike's gerrymandering comment. There's no question that Maryland is one of the most gerrymandered states in the Union. And because of the results of Tuesday's election, where the Republicans were unable to secure a veto-proof majority, or not even a majority, but they needed 19 Senate seats to uphold Governor Hogan's new redistricting plan. They did not achieve that. We picked up 1. So we are still short of getting Governor Hogan's new redistricting plan through. And I think that'll default to the Democrats continuing to make Maryland one of the most gerrymandered states in the union. And I think it's unfortunate because the legislatures in Annapolis do not represent the majority of Marylanders.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sure we're going to have another one, although Texas comes to mind, but that's another issue altogether. We have Mike Prettle. He's with the Wicomico County Democratic Club. Michael Laughlin. He's the Salisbury University political science professor. Also, Mark McIver. He is the current chairman of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee. And former Mayor Barry Tillman, who was also a Democrat, if anybody hadn't noticed. This has been Del Marmer Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.